have died, soon to be nine eternities in doom. Hello and welcome to episode 169 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other devil doctors as masterpieces. I am Nick, the beautiful assistant of this episode, and I'm joined as ever by Roger.
Would you like to be number nine?
And we are back. There has been a brief hiatus for the summer holiday, but we have been busy watching. And what we've been watching this time is horrible, grotesque murdering in the form of, well, Vincent Price. Firstly, as Dr. Fives, and then secondly, as, well, not Dr. Fives, basically. Technically not Dr. Fibes. Let's start with 1971's The
Abominable Dr. Fibes.
Thank you, Roger. I struggle with words sometimes. Well, this is... the plan was to do some Hammer horror that we haven't actually touched on very much before, but we both decided we'd rather like to revisit... Dr. Fibes, who isn't Hammer. I'm struggling with a lot of words today. Is it Amicus, Dr. Fibes? I don't think it was even Amicus, was it?
It's American International Pictures, which is basically Samuel Zadarkov. Very much a what do you mean you want a budget sort of studio.
I wish I could say it didn't show, but actually, they do a lot with what they had.
Well, he was one of the first people to employ Roger Corman before Corman went off to found New World.
There's always got to be a Roger Corman connection somewhere in any film we ever talk about.
They would typically turn out multiple films per month, and if they were on the same sets, so much the better. But
it's cheaper, isn't it? Well, so this is, you could say it's sort of part American. We have a number of American actors in it. Vincent Price, I don't think we've talked about before. I'm so used to him being a kind of caricature of a horror actor, if that makes sense, you know, from all the, his later years were often advertising and appearing in, like, Michael Jackson's Thriller and that sort of thing. It's a slight mental readjustment to me to remember that he was actually, a proper actor and certainly acted in some...
I've seen him much more in the films. I didn't see that much of the advertising, but...
Yeah, so to me... But in a way that I guess Christopher Lee never did, he sort of became a caricature of himself.
Christopher Lee was beyond caricature. I mean, the man recorded a heavy metal album in his 70s.
Well, everyone was too scared to tell him that was a bad idea, right?
Yes, and it wasn't.
It wasn't a bad idea, no. But he also looked like he would probably knife you if you did. Because he had some experience in that film. Anyway, let's move on from Christopher Lee, who we really should talk about at some point. This is the story of... we wanted to do some 70s horror, which we haven't really done before, I don't think, or not for a while. We sort of skipped over it a bit with our werewolf-a-thon, but basically jumped to the 80s for the most part.
For me, it's that slightly awkward era of I was, child to adolescent, and there is stuff that was clearly the zeitgeist of the time that I find more difficult because it was around in my childhood than I do either stuff I saw later when it was new or stuff I saw later because it was vintage.
Because it was so old. Yes, I get your point. Yes, I'm of a slightly... later vintage, though mine was more early 80s, which we have covered before. Still, this is a bit earlier even than your childhood, I believe, Roger, 71.
I was alive, just not watching films.
Yes, fair enough. We also have a returning alumnus in the form of Joseph Cotton, who I was slightly surprised to see. But we have a number of fun actors here. I mean, the story
is... I was in Citizen Kane, I was in Gaslight, I was in The Third Man, I was in Soylent Green, but I'm in this now.
Now I'm in Dr. Fives. I think he was just the sort of actor... I don't know if he was desperate for money. He just always wanted to be working, so he did do a lot of shit, for want of a better term. And I suppose what we're saying here is this is not high art. I mean, the whole, it is a kind of a grand guignol. I don't know. I see its DNA in torture porn films nowadays, which I am not at all a fan of. Except here it's less the kind of, this is a horrible thing we're going to torture you with. It's more, this is the horrible state we're going to leave your corpse in. The premise is Dr. Fibes's wife was in, what happened to her? Was she? She wasn't in a car accident. Yes. That was Dr. Fibes. They were both in a car accident. The surgeons who worked on his wife, and there were 12 of them, done a bad job and she died.
Well, obviously, they couldn't get all their arms in at the same time. Clearly, it's...
the problem with being a doctor is sometimes your patients die, whether you do a good job or a bad job, which sometimes it's hard to tell whether you're doing a bad job or not, but then plenty of other people can tell you that for you, usually. And in this case, the person telling you you've done a bad job is Dr. Anton Fibes. I'm not quite sure what he's a doctor in. Is he a medical doctor?
He is a surgeon.
Okay.
As is mentioned. He's also a famous concert organist, as you know, many surgeons have time to do that.
Yes, he's also a kind of a biblical scholar of some kind.
he simply had a classical education.
He's an incredible electrical engineer, mechanical engineer. He's a polymath, it's fair to say.
Renaissance man, really.
Yes, except he's had his face burned off and can't speak. So the whole, the big reveal of his face is quite exciting. I'm getting ahead of ourselves, really. The story is of the grotesque murders, which the gimmick, was this the first of these kind of gimmicky murders? Which again, I see the DNA in things like Seven later on and Dexter, this kind of serial killer with a theme. It's nice to have a theme when you're a serial killer.
I dare say someone will point out an earlier one, but I think this is the earliest one that I have met, at least.
Yes.
And I think the reason, I agree with you on the torture porn side of things, I don't enjoy that, but I think there's an inherent sense of the ridiculous here. I mean, yes, he is killing people in these bizarre ways, but he has also built some clockwork musicians.
They get a lot more screen time than perhaps they deserve. But there are a lot of shots of Dr. Fibes showing off his organist skills and bizarre clockwork jazz bands playing. I agree. There's kind of a sense of fun and silliness to it. The sequel was actually billed as a comedy horror, and you would be hard pressed to call something like Saw a comedy horror. I agree. What lifts it out of that for me and makes it more comfortable is the kind of tongue-in-cheek ridiculousness of it, which really does work to make it less about the grimy, dirty, oh, look at these horrible things that are happening to these probably horrible people. That is what's happening here.
Yeah.
But it's done in fun.
And you know, some of them may be on the horrible side and some of them aren't. And all right, we have Terry Thomas, who is playing a very Terry Thomas role. I'd love to see him. Yeah, this is a man who in the era is not entirely clear, but I think 1800s. No, there are some.
Cars. And then, but I think
1920s,
it's
maybe.
I would guess it's pretty. It is. Well, that brings me on to one of my points. It's not a sense with a. It's not a film with a great sense of place. You know, some films would really establish this is the 1920s. This is a car pulling up here. It doesn't really do that. Some of the scenes, they could be straight out of the 70s. Some could be from the 50s. I think you extrapolate. Yes, it's probably from the 20s.
But the reason I mention it is that the man has gone to a fair amount of trouble and expense to have his own private pornograph.
Oh my God. It's basically Terry Thomas, not the real man, but the man who the audience expect Terry Thomas to be. The person who, who's the guy from the Carry On films? Nurse Ballet, Ding Dong, in that very much style of British roguery, inherited Terry Thomas's crown of sordid villain, I guess, but in a very upper class way.
So we talk about the director as well, Robert Fust. not I think ever a top flight name, but he directed several episodes of The Avengers, which to me is very obviously the same sort of slightly surreal approach.
Yes.
Right after this, well, these two films, he made The Final Program, which is one of the very few Michael Moorcock adaptations.
Oh, interesting.
It's not quite as out there as Zardoz, but it's in that general direction. He rewrote the script to make Fibes more sympathetic and to add comedy. So I think he has a certain amount of the credit for this, for the bits that we're actively enjoying.
Definitely. I think in that case, he understands that you're kind of there for the grisly murders and the fun of it. Even though, technically we want Dr. Fibes to get caught, you want to see him do all the murders first. He does understand that that's kind of what the audience is for, and doesn't make them feel icky while he does it.
Yeah, there is that thing that I meet in a few things in the general space of, see this horrible murdering person, but it's all right. He's a bad person. He's going to get his comeuppance, so you don't need to feel bad about enjoying it. And yeah.
Yeah, that's a different kind of voyeurism, isn't it? I guess here, I think it was rewritten so he was basically nicer to Virginia North's character, Volnavia.
Volnavia.
So he treats her sort of with respect and as an associate rather than as a kind of Igor-like lackey. So you sort of get where he's coming from, though he probably takes it a bit far. I mean, his idea, this particular theme is the 12 plagues of Egypt, sort of. I mean, not the actual plagues.
Loosely.
Mostly. There are some, he takes some liberties with it, but no one seems to mind. So we have poor old Terry Thomas, the plague of blood, where he's exsanguinated. It's not a bad way to go, I suppose, if you're going to get murdered by Dr. Fibe. We have the plague of locusts, that eat the nurse's face off, who was involved in the procedure. Yeah. Sorry, it does make me, because they are kind of ridiculous, and the ridiculousness is underlined by we have comedy police officers again. We have Inspector Trout,
Peter Jeffrey, a dropping actor of the era.
Yeah, I mean, he's a very familiar face. Yes, yeah. He crops up a lot in 80s and 90s TV shows as well. But he's very... Functionally, they play the same part as the American Werewolf in London pair, to the point where I wonder if the two offices in American Werewolf in London are a nod to these characters. They're almost, like, ripped off from them.
And certainly, they don't do very much in the way of police work. They do ultimately track down who it must be and where he is, but too late.
But too late, because he's got to do all his murders first. I mean, they're not completely incompetent, and they do have a sort of moral core to them. We'll come on to what happens to them in the sequel. But here, at least, they are kind of semi-believable characters who pull the plot along. So what did you... I mean, we're here for the murders, really. As I say, the film is it's slightly amateurish, and as I say, I feel like it's very workmanlike cinematography in a lot of ways, and it's the sense of place is not, well, as you say, it's got its own sense of place in that it's that faintly Avengers kind of prisoner, slightly bonkers.
Well, there were lots of little things that got to me. I mean, your classic mad doctor playing the organ is playing a great big pipe organ. I don't know exactly what that is he's playing, but it's one of your modern electric ones. It might be a Hammond or something like that. It's a flashy one, but it's not your full size.
It's more Bon Tempi than full blown organ. Yes, true.
And that feels as though it ought to have been deliberate somehow. I'm not sure what they were trying to say, but I'm sure they were saying something.
Maybe they were saying we couldn't afford a big organ. Well, it is, yes. There's lots of little things like that are just... I mean, they don't spoil it. They just are, I don't know, less professional or just different.
Yeah, but there are lots of little details that have got right. Fibes' wife, her name is Victoria Regina Fibes. Victoria Regina was the name of the first play Vincent Price was ever in.
Oh, I see. Okay.
her photograph, you may well have recognised.
Yeah? Yes, it's I did recognise it, but I've forgotten her name.
Caroline Munro. Actor,
who wanted to work with Vincent Price, but wasn't allowed to, so I think she was just there as a corpse. she wasn't allowed to act with him or something, so I think she was in there as a dead body at the end.
But, yeah, it's this sort of inevitable progress, but it's always with a sense of fun to it, and I think that's very important.
What we have, really, is a series of set pieces with little cement in between, of either Fibes playing his organ and winding up his Clockwork Jazz Band, or the policeman saying, "Oh, God blimey, another one. Don't tell me it's even more horrible than the last." And then we have the next murder. And as it progresses, the police increasingly try and prevent the murders. They fail in every case except the last one, spoiler. So, yeah. And the joy of it is, it's a bit like the Final Destination joy. So Final Destination is the film where the characters have cheated death, and so death's going to catch up with them in Omen-style fashion. And basically, the fun of each scene is, well, how are they going to meet their end? Is it going to surprise me? I'm not a huge fan of Final Destination because, again, it's got... the better ones have a sense of fun about them. But here it is like... Okay, you're not going to be totally horrified. There's probably going to be a flash of something gruesome at the end because it's a horror film, we have to do that. But really the fun is just seeing what's going to happen to these largely slightly unpleasant people, except Joseph Cotton, I suppose.
Also, it's the early 70s and we are trying for a reasonably permissive certificate.
Yes, yes. So there will probably be some female flesh on show at some point.
I was thinking more that we may have a gory bit where you say ew and turn away, perhaps.
Oh, exactly. Yes,
but
yeah. I see.
It's not going to be the fully detailed whatever.
Well, that's why you will get a flash of someone's face eaten off, and that will be the. But it will be there for a second and gone, and then
yeah, because let's face it, if you looked at it for longer, you would see how slightly faintly rubbish the prosthetic is. Or
I mean, this isn't Tom Savini level of special effects, let alone the thing guy. Oh dear.
Also, I want to know how do you recruit an assistant like that? You know, glamorous assistant needed for an insane killer. Must be utterly loyal and have no moral sensibility.
Well, it would probably work on the internet nowadays. I just don't know where you would go if you didn't have the internet. You'd probably put papers up in shop windows, telephone boxes, that sort of thing. Now, we have an interest...
Valnivia is great in this. We'll talk about her a bit more with the second film, but she is just the silent assistant.
I think she's stunningly beautiful, Virginia North, and she does give this sense of loyalty, and what I like about it, you don't really question that relationship. It's just a kind of a true one on screen. You don't think, why is she doing this? You do start to in the second film a bit, or I did, but in the first one, you just absolutely understand however he recruited her, that's the relationship.
And one of the things that I think is a positive aspect of this is he is utterly loyal to his dead wife.
Oh, yes, yeah. He's in his own twisted way, he's a very moral character. These people have wronged him and they deserve to die. And why he picked the 12 not plagues of Egypt, I'm not entirely sure. But he did. But then we have these fun murders every so often, and they are genuinely very imaginative, for one thing, and they are quite fun to watch. You don't feel like, oh, this is horrible. It's just that's what we're there for, and it delivers really well. I think they're all well thought out. You get to thinking ahead. The bats one is perhaps the least impressive. Is that the one it starts with, the giant bats? I think it is.
I've lost track of the order now. And let's face it, the order doesn't really matter. So.
It doesn't really. You could shuffle them around and it would still work. But we have the snakes on a plane years before snakes on a plane was a thing.
Very fine de Havilland Hornet moth. Lovely, lovely aircraft.
Oh, it wasn't snakes. It's rats on a plane, isn't it? Yeah. Poor rats. Was it? Yes, it's a lovely scene, though. Yeah, so we have these great fun scenes. Then we have Joseph Cotton.
But also, that's one of the things that, yeah, I didn't notice when I probably first saw this in the early 80s or thereabouts. And I simply didn't notice that, they never actually show the plane crashing. They show the plane going out of sight behind the stand of trees and
then we hear a boom
descending, and then we somebody else is looking at it when it goes boom. Because that's a lot cheaper.
It works, doesn't it?
Yes.
You don't mind. You know what's going to happen. Joseph Cotton is perhaps too good an actor for this film.
Nobody told him.
He's just playing it very earnestly, because he is a very good actor, and perhaps hasn't quite got his tongue in cheek in the way that the other stuff. Now, maybe that works in Airplane, where everyone's playing it very earnestly, but this isn't Airplane-style humour. It is humour, but it's the kind of humour where everyone kind of knows they're in a comedy instead of a horror film, I guess, and so they're all hamming it up to that
level. The baseline level of ridiculousness is higher than in our world, sadly.
That is a shame. It is a shame. But he does get the heart of the film, I suppose, Joseph Cotton. So at the end, they've worked out to Dr. Fives that they don't know where he is. He turns out he's just at his house.
There's actually a fairly decent bit of detective work. Basically, we've got these, at this point, five or six victims. What do they actually have in common? They are all medical people. What cases have they worked on together? And they're gradually winnowing that down.
That's a nice scene where he's got all the files and he's like, and I've cut out. It is Joseph Cotton that does all that detective work for the most part, rather than Inspector Trout. But it's well done.
I'm obviously reminded of that splendid bit in one of the Lensman books where they're searching the personnel records of the entire galaxy for people with the right characteristics for a particular job. And there's a card index.
Well, who could imagine anything different back then?
But anyway, yes.
So what did you think? I wanted to ask you about Vincent Price's performance. How did you feel about it?
I'm biased. I would pretty much... I would, you know, the cliche is watching him read the phone book, and I'm not sure about that, but probably I'd watch him read a Bible.
He's got a lot. There's a reason his voice was famous. It's because it is lovely, isn't it? It's velvety and exactly what you need for this sort of thing. It's an interesting form because he can't speak. So what we actually get is Vincent Price gurning while threateningly holding a kind of laryngeal microphone to his throat, and the loudspeaker producing his lovely velvety voice.
But I don't think we actually see his face as such anyway, because it's the prosthetic most of the time, and then right at the end the other prosthetic for the hugely damaged face.
Well, yeah, so he's heavily made up with prosthetic when he's got his fake face on, and then he's got a complete prosthetic when it's his actual face. But it delivers. It's that kind of, oh my God, look at his face, kind of shock moment. It's good.
I have a lot of time for the man, so.
Yeah, I am not, I, as I say, for me, I'm more used to him being kind of a faded star doing stuff for money in a way, and pastiche himself. Here, at kind of the height or towards the end of the height of his powers.
Well, we'll come on to that very shortly, in fact. But I think we could say this is he's starting on the downslope.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's it. He's past the Corman era of, he did a lot of the, Edgar Allan Poe adaptations, didn't he? But here, he's on the slide, but only at the beginning, and he's still at the height of his power. I mean, he does a good gurn, and he does great, great reading. For me, it is, unlike Joseph Cotton, it is exactly the performance you need for this film. It's just perfectly, slightly camp.
I mean, the thing was designed as a vehicle for Price, and I really cannot picture anybody else. You could put somebody else into that role and it could be a good film, but it would not be this film.
I agree. What you talked about Christopher Lee, it would be a very different, more, he's intense, but he's got, there is something, yeah, he's just got the charisma to pull it off. So, Fibes,
Well, let's talk about the ending.
Oh, yes, yeah, okay. So the ending, in this, all the other surgeons have been murdered in various horrible ways, including the theatre nurse. Fibes has now kidnapped Joseph Cotton's daughter, son, and encased him in, in a kind of a surgical table, padlocked to the table. His head is padlocked in place. Well, I mean, this is a really imaginative one. It's bonkers, but I love it. And then there's a vial of acid above his head, or a kind of a tube that is slowly delivering acid down, and it's going to melt through his face. He's got, I think it's like 5 minutes or 10 minutes, and the key to the padlock has been placed inside his pleural cavity. So the doctor, being the surgeon, has now got to, I mean,
operate on his own son in haste.
Once you've performed a thoracotomy on someone, it's quite hard for them to breathe. But anyway, let's not worry about that too much. So he's got to very quickly go into the thoracic cavity, retrieve the key, unlock
obviously
it.
Obviously, he could use the same technique that Fibes used to put it there.
Well, yeah, maybe he went through the same. Maybe it was subcutaneous. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's a really imaginative scene. I like it.
Since the police are breaking in at just the wrong moment, we get Volnovia running out just as the Dr. Vasselis has pushed the trolley away from the acid, and then she stands under it, which is frankly out of character for her. She's not that stupid.
She isn't. Also, I think she dies there, doesn't she?
It's acid. Strongly implied that she dies, yes.
All right. We'll come back to that. I mean, it is a good ending. The son survives. Yes, so Dr. Fibes then descends into the basement, and he's set up this elaborate kind of tomb, mausoleum, and fills himself with formalin. I believe it's formaldehyde, isn't it? It's embalming fluid, which is mostly formalin with a few other things to keep you not decaying, but crucially not in a state of suspended animation. What it will do is kill you.
Yeah, don't try this at home, kids.
But he fills himself with it, and it's a nice ending because he's fulfilled his quest, and that's all he wanted to do. He's avenged his wife, and now he just wants to be with her. So he preserves himself next to her preserved corpse, and the mausoleum closes, and they never find him because it is all... it just looks like a kind of a stone slab mosaic floor sort of thing.
And these are the days before ground penetrating radar.
We think.
But, of course, the film was a success, and so they made a sequel.
Yes, Dr. Fibes Rises Again, or as I like to think of it, Fibes Goes Mad in Egypt. Which is quite a niche pun even for me. Abominable Dr. Fibes, it's great. I mean, I really enjoyed it. It's hard not to love. I'd hesitate to call it a masterpiece, except there are some ways it qualifies as a masterpiece in that Joseph Cotton aside, I don't want to be mean to Joseph Cotton, but he's the one who doesn't seem to get it. It's pitch perfect at the level it's supposed to be. Terry Thomas would be my classic example of the person who gets it right in here, and Vincent Price. It's exactly what you need to be for a slightly ridiculous, silly horror, almost horror comedy, which I think the second film was actually billed as. So I think insofar as it gets something absolutely right, it does. And that's why it's really enjoyable. It's a genuinely really fun film to watch.
I sense a but coming up. I don't despise Dr. Fibes Rises Again. It does start with some possible behind-the-scenes politics because Vincent Price, his box office draw was starting to go down at this point.
Yes.
But he had a good agent, so his salary kept going up. And Robert Quarry, who's here as...
Darius Spiderbeck.
Yeah.
Some hitherto unmentioned nemesis of Dr. Fibes.
Basically, he's an immortal playboy type.
He's an immortal playboy until the end. We do recognise that he's a playboy. But yes, he's sort of inserted in as the obvious guy to oppose Dr. Fibes, even though never mentioned before and we've never heard of him.
And it was at least widely rumoured that he was being set up and eased in gently to be the Vincent Price replacement. And oh no, he's heard this. That Vincent has heard this rumour. They will have to be on set together. What will they do? They apparently got on very well.
So less of less of politics than you're hoping. I mean, why? Not to be mean to Robert Quarry, but he is, compared to Vincent Price, he is something of a charisma vacuum, to be fair. I can't imagine why people felt he was suitable replacement. He just doesn't seem to have any of the qualities that make Vincent Price very watchable. I don't dislike the man, but he's just not. But if if he wasn't in it, I don't know that I'd miss it terribly.
And, you could replace him with many other actors. Some other actor, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
However, a substitution that was made for unavoidable reasons because Virginia North wasn't available. The new Volnavia is Valley Kemp, and to me, she doesn't quite have that cool, completely unruffled grace that the original does.
Yes, I felt more harshly. I thought she was awful, I'm afraid. She just looks like she's vaguely dancing or wafting around. She doesn't really seem to know what she's doing. Also, Volnavia's dead, so I don't know if she's in the new film.
Sorry.
I know, I shouldn't. But maybe the significant plastic surgery explains the entirely different person. I just found a... Whereas the relationship with her and Fives in the first film is brilliant, here she's just forgettable. If she'd been like this in the first film, I wouldn't have thought very much of her at all, I'm afraid.
Mm. But, so Betavac needs some more of the immortality serum or something else.
Which happens to be in the backyard of a secondary base that Dr. Fives has somehow previously built in the base of a pyramid in Egypt. I think
it's genuine antiquity rather than Fives put it there earlier.
But it's got all his clockwork nonsense again, and he's got an organ.
It was shipped in.
Okay.
Yeah, this is not perhaps entirely well thought through. We see, I think, one of the first dungeon maps on film.
Yes. We also have Peter Cushing in this one very, very briefly as the captain of the ship.
Mm.
It doesn't make... I mean, it's not bad, isn't it? But he doesn't really have a huge amount to do.
I mean, it's lovely to see him, I agree.
Yes. We have returning Terry Thomas, unexplained as a different character, except not as a different character because he still looks identical and behaves identically to the previously dead. I'm going to assume he was his twin brother.
In 1970s England, there are a lot of men who look like and look and act like Terry Thomas.
I mean, I can see the logic. Terry Thomas is great. Can we get him in this new film? Will anyone mind? No, it's Terry Thomas. Unfortunately, it hasn't got much to do, really. He's just a shipping magnate who doesn't really do a lot of fun home porn watching, which his first character did. And I think in a way that characterises the rest of the film in that it all feels a bit thrown together. There isn't really any kind of internal logic that holds it together in any way, to the point where not only do you not quite understand the motivations of these characters very well, you don't really care either because the film doesn't care that much. And that applies to the murders in this film as well. You know, we're here for the fun, murdery things that Dr. Fives did last time. And they're here, but there's no kind of theme to them.
I would say the best of them is probably the snake and telephone bit.
Well, I agree. So that's a...
and that's fairly early.
That's like a random clockwork snake that's chasing a heavy round a room. And the way he finally gets is he picks up the telephone. Does the telephone start ringing or he grabs it to call someone? But it at that point, it fires a golden snake through his brain, which is a surprise.
But on the ship, we have an entirely mundane strangling, which is...
Yeah, that was held up as one of the best ones. Again, that's another recurring character. That was Hugh Griffith, who previously appeared as the rabbi in the other film now recurs as another different character.
Because obviously if you want somebody who knows about the Bible in 1920s England, you go to a rabbi.
So yeah, he gets strangled by Dr. Five, and then there's a cute bit where he gets put in a giant perfume bottle, but again, it's Dr. Five's just sort of strangled him, and then, oh, there's a giant perfume bottle, wouldn't it be fun to put him in there? It's got less of the kind of fun to it.
I do like the illuminated glass transport coffin for Victoria. The visual grammar to me is kind of game show, you know. Now see the prize you could have won.
Again, Caroline Munro in a non-speaking, non-moving part, but she gets to work with Vincent Price again, so that's nice. Dr. Fibes, who, as previously discussed, has self-embalmed, now turns out to have been in a state of suspended animation, just
all
waiting.
All it needs is for the blood to be put back in.
Yes, yeah, so really don't try this at home. But he set this kind of timer to work out, so when the stars are right or the moon's in the right place or when the immortal river is about to burst its banks or whatever, that, at that point he's got to get to Egypt. But someone, the MacGuffin is that Robert Quarry has pinched the scroll that he needs. Except that he never needs that scroll again. I don't really. It's just a point to set him off. It becomes a sort of a chase movie, except
with,
not quite.
With Egyptian archaeological shenanigans.
Yeah, I mean, it's fun. I love the setting. I love Egypt. The murders are a little.
Obviously, you could just instantly lay hands on the giant self-powered fan to simulate a sandstorm.
Yes, or an enormous. Kind of human press that someone gets squashed into. they're all interesting deaths. Again, the one where he's sellotaped to a sphinx and he's not sellotaped, but he's tied to a sphinx and then a load of scorpions come out. They're interesting, but they're just a bit. They seem to be like opportunity murders, but they're also elaborate deaths. And it's just, you have to think, how did he set this up in the middle of, or how, this is the middle of the desert? How did,
hasn't had time to plot and prepare.
But he still comes up with these incredible. So, yes, the deaths themselves are fun. There's fewer of them. And they feel a bit more random. We also have the return of Inspector Trout and mm-hmm. his supervisor. But here they are. I mean, before they were slightly bumbling, but they were police officers. Now they basically they're like the police officers in Tintin. They're just absolutely bumbling idiots who do almost nothing for the plot. And when they do, it's purely by accident. And you know, they weren't pinnacles of characters to begin with, but I feel they just reduced to absolute comedy idiots. To the level of Denham Elliott's character in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, just bumbling around. Does anybody here speak English? I don't know. I felt slightly offended on their behalf. Vincent Price, however, is still Vincent Price.
Yes.
And gives great Vincent Price, remains absolutely who he should be for the film.
What is clear. All right, it is the Rolls Royce of glass coffins.
It's a very impressive bit of coffin.
The thing that did strike me, though, was there's a few bits where they're poking through the pyramid. And something I haven't noticed before, which possibly suggests the film wasn't distracting me enough, but here is a bit that is clearly meant to be lit by one lantern that the guy is carrying. Therefore, the light source is moving. How do you do that when you have, you know, all these, you know, obviously you need a lot more lights than that and you need bigger ones and none of them could be visible. It works.
Yes. There are some nice moments to it, some individual scenes. I agree. And the kind of the archaeology, the exploration, the claustrophobia, some of that really does work. I agree.
But yeah, overall it doesn't come together in the same way. I agree. Except it's right at the end, of course.
Well, even then, I felt that was a bit of a damp squib with the kind of the lake and the it was the elaborate kind of we're going to flood this place now, and I didn't feel the stakes were as high. I didn't care about Robert Quarry at all because he was utterly... No. He's kind of... They're trying to make him sort of a sympathetic villain, but he's not really. He's just an arsehole.
But Vincent and Virginia get to live forever.
Well, yes. Yeah, well, that's a nice nice ending. But I don't know if they can never come out. I don't... I think what it shows me is, even when you're doing a ridiculous thing like this... And I get similarly with Airplane. Even when the actual film is ridiculous, you need some kind of plot to follow along. Otherwise, it's just like a sketch show. Mm. And you can watch a sketch show for half an hour or so, but watching a sketch show, same reason Meaning of Life is the least of the Monty Python films, even though there's some very funny bits in it. It's because just watching disconnected sketches is less narratively satisfying. I think you need something to hang a story on. And here... It's almost like you feel they've got so much contempt for you as an audience that they're like, oh, no one will notice. They can't be bothered. And there comes a point where you're like, actually, I do notice that, and I slightly resent being...
I never quite got that feeling, but I can't argue with you on that. So,
not a masterpiece, and certainly not up to its previous film. I wouldn't recommend unless you... I would recommend it if you really like Vincent Price, and why don't you? But there are much better Vincent Price movies out there, particularly...
For example,
Dr. Five.
The next year...
Next year, we have not Dr. Fives, we have Vincent Price in Theatre of Blood.
And they did ask Robert Fussbach to direct this, but he said, no, I don't want to be that. Don't want to be the Vincent Price does obscure theme-killing movies guy.
That's fair enough. I wonder if he had directed it, it maybe would have felt so similar to Dr. Fibes, that it would have basically been Dr. Fibes 3. Here it is actually, despite the similarity of theme. So the theme in this one is we have Edward Lionheart, who is a pissed off actor because there are a number of critics who deliberately snubbed him, with the Critics' Choice Award.
To be fair, he does appear to have been generally accepted by everybody except himself as fairly rubbish.
Well, that was what was not entirely clear to me in the film. Was it that they had snubbed him because he deserved it, but they were mean to him, or whether, as I think he's right, and I think you're implying, it was only Edward Lionheart who felt he deserved it, and everyone else knew he was a real ham of an actor. But it's a great idea because it allows Vincent Price to absolutely ham it up and do some real terrible kind of over-the-top acting, and that is the whole point of his character.
Yeah, one of the reasons he took the part was that he had never been cast in Shakespeare and always wanted to be cast in Shakespeare. And at least here he got to do some of the soliloquies.
Yes, the shtick of Edward Lionheart, his character, is that he only ever acts in Shakespeare, refused to do anything else. And so he knows all of the plays inside out and he gets to do a lot of the speeches. So what he decides to do is knock off the critics, one by one, in the style of a Shakespeare play in every case. For instance, we have a Merchant in a Venice murder where... someone has a pound of flesh removed from them, and we have Richard III, where someone is drowned in a vat of
wine. Yep.
Yes, and so on. We have someone, my Shakespeare is not, up to scratch, but I mean, some of them, there are some liberties taken with the, with the
just
plot.
A bit, yeah.
but that's the shtick. So we have themed murder, aggrieved, actor in this case, but the whole style of the film is quite different, which is why I think so. We've got Douglas Hickox,
beautiful and obsessed daughter.
Yes, Diana Rigg is in this one.
Anything with Diana Rigg in it. Let's face
I mean, never going to complain about Diana Rigg. I would say she's almost too good for this part, but it's actually a very similar role, isn't it? Really, she's fanatically loyal. She has a more active role in it, in that she initially appears to be the sensible one, and it turns out she's actually the accomplice who is willing to commit all these murders with her father.
I think the thing that struck me as distinct was the Price character he's obsessed, but he's not absurd, the way Phibes was.
I agree.
So there is humour in the specific setup of the killings, but you know, there are no clockwork musicians or anything of that sort.
Well, as you said last time, the level of the absurd in the Phibes films is just turned up a notch from reality, or several notches from reality. But here it is, you know, inherently ridiculous, but it has a realism to it, which initially, when I first watched it, I responded very well to. I thought, oh, it's more like a proper movie. But as the film went on, it occurred to me, it's actually less fun because of that in a way. It does lose some of the tongue-in-cheekness of it.
And there, a significant part of this, basically, he was thought to have jumped off a building or fallen off a bridge or something of that sort. But anyway, he was thought to have gone into the river.
But he's actually landed with a group of homeless...
Yeah, and you know, we've got these homeless people who are meth drinkers and clearly with a variety of mental problems, and that it feels a bit generic.
It's a bit lazy characterization of that. These are like the subhuman people who live under society, which is not. It felt a bit thoughtless.
And it's a bit like that whole, you know, all the street gangs are going to take over the world thing that you get later on.
Yeah, it's got like a slightly grimy, mean streets feel to it. The whole thing, the murders are they're imaginative. They're nicely themed. But as you say, they're just a bit less macabre, perhaps is the right word. They've got less of that sense of grand guignol. They're just a bit... they're more like, I'm going to stab you, but I'm going to stab you in a Shakespeare way. I mean, in a way, the vat of wine one is the most... there's one where poor Captain Mannering, Arthur Lowe, gets his head removed... I mean, that one actually, Vincent Price is the one who elevates it to the level of ridiculous. Because his behaviour during that, you know, while he's actually removing someone's head while they're alive, he's just got this sense of camp enjoyment about it, which is sometimes missing from the other murders, I think.
Mm. Yeah, it's a different flavour. It's not as much to my taste as the one with Dr. Phibes, but it does still work. We've also got a pretty solid cast. Ian Hendry, who did a bit of everything about this at the time. Also, a almost crossover, because he was the lead in the first series of The Avengers before Diana Rigg came along.
Oh, interestingly. Okay, I did not know that. All right. We have Michael Horden. Early on, I love Michael Horden. Robert Morley, it's hard not to enjoy Robert Morley.
And we've actually seen him in A Ribbon of Musical before. High Road to China.
Oh, yes, yes. He is great. Eric Sykes pops up at some point. Diana Dawes, Arthur Lowe, I've mentioned. Diana Rigg, of course, as well. Robert Morley gets one of the fun, sort of fun murders that he has to eat his own children in that they cook his. I don't know, I always get slightly weary of films with animals in that sense, because I just know right from the start, I mean, they already knew in this one, and it's really well done, but I just get a bit tired of performative animal cruelty. But perhaps
there is no on-screen animal cruelty, but it is strongly implied, and it is at least suggested that this is funny.
It's when it's played for laughs, so funny.
What do you make of Inspector Boot?
I didn't,
My feeling of Milo O'Shea is he just doesn't seem to be in quite the right place.
I was hesitating. It just, whereas I enjoyed Inspector Trout, even though he's sort of incompetent, he feels like he's in a more serious film again. He just doesn't seem to quite get it. I didn't find him especially charismatic. In a way, I suppose Ian Hendry is more of the action hero of the film, sort of. But they're the two...
You're a friend of the murdered man. I will quite happily let you wander around this crime scene unattended.
Yeah, it's pretends to be more serious. I feel like, in a way, the whole film has just, to my taste, played the wrong way, and that is an example of it. You would accept that in a Phibes film, because it's just, you know, it is a silly film. But here, because it's, you know, it's filmed more on video. The cinematography is much better. It's filmed on more grainy cinematic film.
Also shot entirely on location.
Yeah, so it's got a very different feel to it, much more kind of open and much more kind of that. It's sort of got a kind of a French Connection feel in the way it's filmed, and I'm not sure that suits the subject matter as well to me. I feel like I'm being down.
Vibes is not gritty.
Exactly. This is kind of slightly gritty and grimy, right down to, you know, the homeless people and the, you know, there's more drug taking. It's just a bit grimy. I think it is moving, maybe what I found not quite distasteful. I did enjoy the film, but it's just slightly moving towards the torture porn things that I really don't like, in that it's just being a bit more down to earth and realistic and gritty. And I'm making it sound like it's a super serious film. We have Robert Morley eating his own poodles and Vincent Price doing the tanning someone to death in a huge afro. So, I mean, I'm not saying it's a super serious film. I just feel it was maybe, for my taste, played a bit wrong.
Yeah, there are some things that don't quite mesh together. I do want to mention some of the locations. The theatre was an actual theatre. It was the Putney Hippodrome, which had been built 70-odd years earlier, but it was closed in the 60s.
Oh, lovely. So it was an actual fallen-into-disrepair theatre.
Yeah, and then a few years after this was made, they knocked it down to put up housing. And that flat that the Critics' Circle meets in...
Oh, that's a lovely flat.
Yeah, belonged at the time to Stanley Baker, a successful actor of the 50s.
From Zulu.
Sadly, was later bought by Geoffrey Archer, so I don't suppose the stench will ever go away, but it's still a nice flat.
God. Well, that's a blast from the past. There are some lovely locations. And we have some great... Again, it's a film of, like, vignettes of little sketches of these murders. And they are well done, some of them. I mean, Vincent Price is, once again, great in it. This time he can actually... speak, and he does play a different sort of character. Maybe that's because he can move more, but whereas Fibes is fiercely loyal and kind of moral in his own way, Edward Lionheart is much more of a conceited prick. There is a nuance there, even though they're both basically the same sort of character. Fibes is probably a nicer person in a weird sort of way. Edward Lionheart's just out for revenge because of wounded pride rather than his wife died. So it's just, he's less of a nice character, but he's still...
I could picture having a pint with Fibes. Yeah, post-murder.
Yeah. Maybe peri-murder, if you were lucky. Whereas Vincent Price is absolutely the kind of... Edward Lionheart is the kind of person you would... If you went into a room and they were there, you would probably, if they hadn't seen you, go out of the room again. Mind you might do that with Dr. Fibes, to be fair. Overall, I mean, it's a funny one, Theatre of Blood. It isn't really, I went into it thinking this was effectively Fibes 3. It sounds like it's going to be, but it actually plays quite differently. I like it a lot. In many ways, it's a more accomplished film, more professional and less amateurish.
But in spite of the fact that I suggested we put this in as part of the Fibes-a-thon, I would agree with you, it is not quite the same sort of thing.
No, it feels different. And it's, I think crucially, as you've been saying, it's just a bit less fun. When Vincent Price is on the screen, it's good. When we are led really by Ian Hendry and Milo O'Shea, I just don't find them that compelling to watch, and so I'm just waiting for those to finish. In a way that I wasn't really with Inspector Trout, I was enjoying those little filler bits too.
And overall, I would certainly put The Abominable Dr. Fibes first.
Yes.
I think I would rate this slightly above Dr. Fibes Rises Again, but that my opinion will vary, and next week I may feel differently.
Well, it's probably closer to a masterpiece, technically, in a lot of ways. I think some people do really consider Theatre of Blood a masterpiece. I would, much as I think it's undeniably a better film than Dr. Fibes Rises Again, I'd probably enjoy watching Dr. Five Rises again more. Just, yeah, if only in a it's so bad it's good sort of way. I don't think any of them are quite masterpieces, but I do think Vincent Price is Master Lee in all of them and gets it absolutely right. And is brilliant. I mean, he, as you say, he makes those films, and including Theatre of Blood. Yeah, you could make Theatre of Blood without Vincent Price, but it would not be the same film, and probably wouldn't be as good.
I tell you the person I would pick for a remake, Patrick Stewart, circa 1990s.
Yes, he has got a nice deadpan sense of, yeah, that's a good idea. Well, maybe there will be a remake. It is the sort of film that probably would be ripe for a remake when that kind of horror comes around again. It's not really horror, is it?
Yeah. But also, I think you need to have the right sort of person in all of these. Yeah. As you say, it is the film it is because of Vincent Price more than anybody else.
I think with this sort of, it's a hard one to get right. You've got to have a bit of a twinkle in your eye. I suppose in the way that there's a difference between The Princess Bride, where everyone kind of knows the sort of film they're in, and they're all, you know, there is a slightly nudge, we're in a comedy. It's not too far, but it works. If you try that in a film like Airplane, it absolutely ruins it. So it's, you know, it's a hard kind of way to get, but in this one, you do need people to be a bit more Robert Morley and a bit less Ian Hendry, I suppose.
And a lot more Terry Thomas.
And a lot more Terry Thomas. That, maybe that's what's missing from this film, is Terry Thomas. He was still alive at the time, I believe. Yeah, he died in the 90s, I think. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I don't want to sound like this Sensual Death List podcast.
So I would certainly put The First Wives on my personal masterpiece list.
Fair enough. I don't think I quite would. I'd like to watch more 70s horror. I would like to delve into Hammer horror, because I think probably some of those would be higher than five. But it's very memorable and absolutely brilliant in what it does. Not quite a masterpiece for me. The other two, less so.
I enjoyed them. I'm glad to have watched them again, yes. But yes.
I had a great time watching all of them, and particularly enjoyed watching Vincent Price. It made me want to go back to watch some of his old Corman films as well. We haven't done. Have we done a Roger Corman? I don't think we have. Perhaps there's a reason for that.
Excuse me. Be on the Seven Samurai in Space. Anyone? Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. Yes. which we did enjoy. If only for a couple of things in the Space Valkyrie. But let's with that bombshell, wind it up there. No murders during the podcast. So that's
a good. Brass unicorn has been catapulted across a London street and impaled an eminent surgeon. Words fail me.
Very good.